So this is the UVic Military Oral History Program interview with Commodore David Craig, recorded on March 14th at the University of Victoria. Commodore Craig, do I have your permission to record this interview?
You most certainly do.
My first question is, where did you grow up?
I grew up in really two places. I was born in Medicine Hat, Alberta, in 1955, very long time ago, now it seems. Small town then, about 25,000 people. And I went to elementary school up until grade three. And then events in my life transpired that my mother took me to Vancouver. And that's where I did the rest of my growing up. I went to Van Horn Elementary and then John Oliver Secondary, and then went to university there up until 1978.
Awesome. And why did you join the Canadian Naval Reserve?
Well, that's an interesting question. It had its origins in the fact that my mother took me down to Sea Cadets when I was 13. She was looking for male role models in my life. I tried Boy Scouts, but it really wasn't working out too well. And so a friend of hers suggested that she enrolled me down to Sea Cadets when I was 13. And it was something I was quite interested in. That was the origin of my interest in the military. And I went there until I was 17, 18. In fact, I intended to stay and become a Sea Cadet officer, but I was convinced otherwise by officers who were both Sea Cadet officers and Naval Reservists.
Okay, and why did you join that branch in particular?
I stopped there because I thought it was an interesting transition to your next question. I had gone to Quadra, the Sea Cadet camp there, and was about to join their officer cadet program. The two officers that were the band officer and the guard officer, they were both interested and involved in the Naval Reserve. The band officer in particular was the band officer for both the Sea Cadet Band and for the Discovery Band. And he convinced me, as well as the CO of the Sea Cadet Corps, that I really should join the Naval Reserve. I was about to start university, and they felt the opportunities with the Naval Reserve were that much more than the Sea Cadet organization. So although I was reluctant to leave it, having put 5 years there, I was actually the chief of the Corps. I joined the Naval Reserve when I started university and went on from there.
Awesome. And could you tell me about the training when you first started, like
Yeah,
when you
the
first joined?
time that I joined was a very interesting time. The University Naval Training Divisions, UNTD program, had ceased to exist back in 1968 when the forces had unified. And the officer cadet program had largely stopped between 1969 and about 1972. And there was reasons for that. Integration was the biggest reason. We had, at that point, just transitioned to the new green uniform back in 1974. And there was a whole lot of pain and angst. In fact, the Naval Reserve hadn't yet, being the last organization to transition, gone to the new uniforms. There were still a few blue uniforms in, and we were the first to go into the green uniform. But all that to say, the reserve organization itself was in a big transition. A lot of the reserve officers had left over integration and transitioning to the new uniform, and the reserve had shrunk. And we were also the first of the new cadets who were starting a brand new program. Now, when I joined in 1974, the program had started in 1972, so there were a couple of years ahead of me. We were called the Reserve Officer University Training Program, as opposed to the regular officer training program, so ROUTP. vice ROTP. But the philosophy was that unlike the old UNDD program, which was a completely separate training program solely for people going to university, the philosophy of the new program was to integrate us in as much as possible regular force training. Interestingly, the fellow who was given the task of bringing up that program from scratch was a fellow named Stu Alsgaard. And Stu Alsgaard had been the CEO of HMCS Quadra, the Sea Cadet training program. So there was a lot of crossover. In fact, he brought a number of principals from the Sea Cadet organization over to the new university program. But the program had downsized, so previously there had been about 300 per year, fairly large contingent. And now the total number of officer cadet intake had shrunk to 60. So there were four of us that joined from Discovery. And our training program was unique that we were allowed to train alongside and with our regular force counterparts in the summer. And so our training program became very much the same, and we did the same program, and we competed against, in our courses, regular force officers, some of whom I went on to serve with in various capacities throughout my career.
Could you tell me what the relationship was like between the regular Navy and reserve? And how well do the personnel work together?
It was an interesting time. The regular force were divided into two groups. There were those who went to the military college. We called them ring knockers because they wore these gigantic rings from the college. And then there were the university types who were very much like us. They went to a civilian university, but they did their summer training program the same way we did, at least for the first 3 years. So we had much more in common from our perspective with the civilian types that went to civilian university instead of the military. So there was a little bit of a split there, but as far as actually doing the courses together, we did our reserve classes separately up to the point at which we went to sea. And then our sea training was the same. And I found that we were as much prepared, or maybe even better prepared than we went when we went to sea than the regular force group were. For example, I topped the program in both first and second year, even though they had perhaps more training at military college. We had the advantage that we poured everything we had in the summer because this was our chance to be part of the Navy.
And I'd like to go back to your civilian career and what that relationship was like between you working in the reserve and you in the civilian life.
My whole career has been one of being part of the Navy, either as a civilian or military. I think my choice of courses were shaped by my naval experience. What I did know and why I didn't join the regular force is that although I found it really interesting to do, it wasn't something that I wanted to do full time. It didn't capture my interest enough. I knew I wanted more of an academic career. I decided in university to take engineering physics because it was one that appealed to me academically. I didn't have to choose what type of job I was going to be channeled into because you took all sorts of different elements of all the engineering, civil, mechanical, electrical. I chose to specialize more in electrical, but I ended up taking a number of elective courses that oriented me to electronics, and I took a course in oceanography. And I did some projects related to gear that the Navy was using. So in the end, as I graduated, and I had spent consecutive summers working toward my bridge watching keeping certificate, by the time I graduated, I had finished the initial training. I had got my bridge watchkeeping certificate, and I had spent a summer or two at sea. So I went for job interviews, and one of them was with the Defense Research Establishment in Victoria. And they were doing oceanographic research, and the fellow came to interview me. And he was impressed by the fact that I had done projects with and oriented around oceanography, because that's what their program was, with my bachelor's degree. And he said one of the main questions he had was, did I get seasick? Odd question, because he seemed to be more concerned about whether I got seasick as to whether I got straight A's or what my coursework was. And that was because the previous hires had gone out on these cruises and been unable to function. And I said, I can guarantee you I don't get seasick. I've got a bridge watching certificate. I might take a day or two to adapt, but I'm fine. And so that actually influenced them into giving me a job. Originally, I was to be more in the research support. Once I started work with them, they could see that I was much more interested in research, and so they gave me the opportunity with three-quarters pay and full pension to go back to school to get my master's degree and eventually my PhD. I did a master's degree in electrical engineering, specializing in processing hardware, array processing hardware, because that's what I was doing mostly out at sea, was programming and support. But then as I moved into research and I got more into the science of detecting submarines, my research was to go back in real-time processing and do a PhD in computer engineering, specializing in detection and real-time software. So there's been a constant overlap. I spent 17 years in the Defense Research Establishment doing anti-submarine research. At the same time, the fact that I was able to go back to university and had my summers off enabled me to do a lot more follow-up time at sea. Getting time and experience and working toward the command exams necessary to get my command qualification. So by the time I finished my master's degree and had done a number of times at sea as the executive officer, I was able to sit the board and was granted my command qualification in 1984. So I think there was a synergy between my university time and my ability to progress up in the Naval Reserve.
Awesome. And how common was it for the Canadian Naval Reserve to serve on regular ship deployments?
When I joined, I mentioned to you we did common training with the regular force, but that was only up to the point at which we split off toward a minor war vessel command, aka the gate vessels back in our day. And the regular force people went on and did advanced training on the destroyers. The destroyers and that training required training during the winter. So we did three full summers, two of which were gaining initial experience with the regular force in our first summer, our navigation training in the second summer, and they were with the regular force. And our third summer, which was getting our minor war vessel certificate, was done on our own platforms. There were, in my time, very few people who took the option and got their regular force watchkeeping ticket. It wasn't offered to that many people. There might have been a handful. And the Naval Reserve full-time staff in those days was an office of people, maybe a dozen, down on South Street in Halifax as an adjunct to the regular force. So really small numbers on full-time service and very small staff. So the ships that we had, the gate vessels, were our primary focus because they were manned by and operated on weekends by Naval Reservists. They weren't run full-time. So the commonality between the two, really we're a bit of a separate world after we did our initial training together.
Okay, and did you deploy outside of Canadian waters? Like, did reservists ever deploy or yourself?
In our initial training with the regular force, in my first summer, we went down to San Francisco, San Diego, and it was a great experience. In my second summer, we went up to Alaska and did all our training. The first summer was on destroyers, the old steamers. The second summer was on regular force minesweepers. But then that third summer and beyond, we still did coastal steaming. We went as far down as to Portland and up the Columbia River and as far up as to Ketchikan, Alaska. One of the things that happened, which I was very fortunate with, is in 1977, I was given the opportunity to, as a result of placing first in the cadet program, be selected to go to England for the Silver Jubilee cruise, which was a great opportunity. I went on a, at that time, new 280. They had just been commissioned on the Huron, and got some opportunity to serve as an officer watch on board a regular force destroyer, which was a wonderful opportunity and a great experience. But during the first, I would say from 1978 when I started and right through to 1984, I spent all my time at sea on gate vessels and weekends.
And what did you do on those weekends?
We would join the ship on a Friday, and we would check everyone out and make sure that they knew what they were doing. Sometimes we would do what was called a fast cruise, which is really as if you're at sea, but you're still tied up, just simulating doing various things that you would need to do when you're out at sea. And then sail Saturday morning. We would usually either come to a port on Saturday night, often over to Port Angeles, and then come back and tie the ship up either in the afternoon if it was just us from Victoria, or typically at noon. I, because of the fact I had a command ticket, was often the one taking naval reservists out from other parts of the country. So they would fly in on a Friday. The advance party, or the people getting the ship ready, would fly in maybe on a Thursday and get all of the stores on board, the food and the navigation supplies, get the ship ready to go, and then we would sail on a Saturday morning, come back on a Sunday at noon, and then they would fly out to all parts of the country. When I did my master's degree in 82, I went to Ottawa, and that's where I did my master's degree. I hadn't gotten my command certificate. That was back in 81, 82, and so I did a number of cruises as the executive officer in the St. Lawrence, and circumnavigating Newfoundland. It was a great time up in the Great Lakes, and had a lot of fantastic experience.
As an executive officer, what was your role on the ship's deployment?
Twofold. One is you had to make sure that all the rest of the crew knew what they were doing for the captain and assign the various responsibilities to people. But secondly, you were under training yourself, so that was a time where I really learned about ship handling and doing evolutions, alongsides and anchoring and doing replenishment alongside another vessel, getting the fine art of ship handling there. And once I got my command ticket in 84, then as a commanding officer, my responsibility was to train other executive officers into getting their command ticket. Typically, it takes about 2 to 3 years as an executive officer before you're ready to sit a command board. And then the failure rate is over 50%. So a lot of people take 2 or 3 times at the board to get a command ticket.
And so when the MCDVs arrived, what did you do on them?
Well, my time was from 84, and the MCDVs didn't arrive till about 95. And I was one of those who was promoted early, so I became a lieutenant commander in 81, so very early. And I became a commander in 84, so I was one of the youngest through. So by the time I got to 95, I was promoted captain. And I was too senior to be transitioned to the new MCDVs. So it bypassed my generation, my time. My time was a gate vessel. And I spent 15 years quite happily on board them.
Could you tell me more about being a commander and what that role pertained?
It was a different time back then. As compared to the Navy today, we had one radio, an HF radio, an old World War II relic. And we would typically get our messages once or twice a day from a radio relay in Chilliwack if the propagation conditions were not too bad. So largely when you left, you were on your own. And there were no cell phones back in those days. So no communication. It was very much a bonding experience with the crew when we went on these longer deployments. You had a supply officer on board, you would come in. I did a cruise up the St. Lawrence from Halifax, and it was a great time where we would just come in, buy steaks, buy strawberries, have a bonding experience with the crew. You got to know them very well. It was a small crew, so typically be about 30. You'd have cribbage tournaments on board when you're out at sea, parties when you're at anchor. In those days, there was, I wouldn't say unlimited liquor on board, but there was a lot of liquor consumed. It was a different time than we have today. Some real challenges. I remember my most memorable experience was out at sea off, about 400 miles off Newfoundland. We were heading up to Lake Melville and Goose Bay, Labrador, doing a training evolution. And it was a very big swell. I mean, the wind wasn't too bad, but the swell caused the ship to go significantly up and down. And I managed on one of those swells because of slack. We were doing a towing evolution where we threw a towing line to another ship, managed to catch the towing rope. I originally thought around my screw. But over a period of time, managed to figure out how to get the rope out of where it had caught on the king post. And that was my most exciting moment, because if I hadn't been able to get the rope out of there, we were 400 miles from nowhere with a storm coming in. So I think that you're, as a commanding officer, you're very conscious of the safety of the crew, knowing that you're probably the most experienced on board, and your decisions are life and death, literally life and death decisions. That was probably my most scary moment. My next most scary moment was when I was the navigating officer and we were on a herring roe patrol. This was in 1979. I volunteered to go for a month and we did ostensibly safety patrol for the herring roe season. I went with serving under a commanding officer who I won't name. for his own protection. But there were just many things that went wrong. We managed to destroy the Prince Rupert Fisherman's Co-op by slicing right through the wharf. That wasn't his fault. There was a clutch linkage that broke. But part of that reason was we went through Sansom Narrows and he went through and figured out the tide at the wrong time. I had advised him that that wasn't a good idea. But he thought he could sneak through going on the edge of the current. And we sped the engines, blew the overspeed trip, and did donuts going down Sansom Narrows toward the rocks before we could get the engine restarted. That was very exciting. And then the last one was when we were at sea trying to go into Sandspit, Queen Charlotte City. It was a terrible storm, and literally I was a navigating officer coming in on that trip. All the buoys were blown off. The waves were coming over, and one wave blew the door in, soaked the radar, and shorted it out. We couldn't see a thing. So we were literally coming in on this sand spit, absolutely blind. And fortunately, we managed to get alongside, but that was a very nerve-wracking moment for me. So those aren't all the scary moments. I've had other ones at sea, but maybe a bit of luck managed to salvage my career.
Mm-hmm. If you like, you can tell me more about those moments.
Another moment that I had a very interesting time was when I was in Ottawa, and we went down to Kingston, and we had another officer whom I won't name, and he decided that he was going to put a little dash and excitement in. So he had some friends in the Air Reserve. We flew down Friday night, and he put everyone on board. And rather than do the normal checkout, he decided that we would simply slip and sail and everything was going to be fine. What could go wrong? Well, I was the executive officer at that time, and I was handling the lines. He managed to back away too quickly and we caught a line, so I had to bring the ship back and we had to send a ship in and slip the line. But at that point, he had managed to get himself completely disoriented. And by the time I got the crew back on board, he was a little rattled at having caught the line and having been delayed in slipping. So he backed out in the pitch dark, figuring he knew where he was going, but he was turned around, he backed up straight onto a sandbar in the middle of Kingston Harbor on a Friday night. So he thought, well, didn't want to stay there, so he had me take the sea boat, and one of the ways is that you can kedge off. So what you do is, he had the sea boats running with off the stern, trying to pull us off the bank at the same time as he was trying to use the engines. Unfortunately, as I was up on the bridge, the two boats were there in the pitch dark trying to go, and the line had gone slack and actually had gone around the screw. And as he went forward, he drew the boat unknowns to them straight back, and the next thing they knew, they were right up against the hull being dragged under the water. So and it just happened to them all of a sudden, because they thought they were going forward, but they were being pulled back by the line that had caught around the screw. So they jumped out of the boat at the last minute. The boat went under the water and got sliced up in the screw, went to the bottom. We rescued the men, very fortunately, escaping the screw. And now we were in the middle of Kingston Harbor with a line wrapped around us, hard on a bank, with the sun coming up in the morning and all of the people in the Holiday Inn having seen us right outside their window. It was a terribly, terribly embarrassing time. In the end, we had to get divers from CFP Kingston to come down and get the line out from the water. That was done by around Sunday at lunch, enough to tow us in and go home. He was given the option of either a board of inquiry or resigning quietly, and he chose the option of resigning quietly. Mm-hmm. So sad end to a career, but very much a lesson for me about never assuming that things are going to go well. If you assume what's the worst thing that can happen and prepare against it, it saves you a lot of grief.
You were, I'd like to go back to, you were mentioning how back in 74, around that time, a lot of officers were leaving because of the uniforms. Could you explain more about that?
Yes. There was a great emotional tie to the Royal Canadian Navy. And a lot of people felt that the Royal Canadian Navy died in 1968. So those that stayed were generally the younger officers. But at the same time, those officers that retired maintained a connection to the mess. And they were, when we had our mess dinners, they were the ones that taught us the customs and traditions of the Navy. So they may have left the Navy, but they didn't necessarily leave the whole social environment. Also in 1974, there were a significant number of people that had served in Korea and in World War II. Less so much in World War II, but they were still around as the veterans. So they had first-hand tales of the war. And it was a different environment because those people had actually served at sea in sea battles and had a somewhat different perspective of the Navy. The Navy in the 70s was more the new Navy, the green uniforms, was it's an office adventure. I mean, it was going to be a time where it was a come-as-you-are war. It was a nuclear time. And so the reserve was largely relegated to not expected to be part of the regular force, but backfill the regular force in short positions if the event happened and you'd have to man all those ships. So much so that that philosophy was in existence from 1978 right through probably the mid-80s to about the time the MCDVs were envisioned. We had this whole mythical organization called the Maritime Coastal Defense Organization. And we were assigned a billet that we would go to on a shore billet. And we also were assigned to a minor war vessel billet. This was up to the late 80s. And we exercised as if we had all these coastal defense vessels. And then when they actually arrived in the mid-90s, the concept of how they were going to be used changed tremendously. What happened was the regular force discovered that they were far too capable a vessel just to be run on the weekends. The original concept was that we were going to man them much as we did with the gate vessels. We would use them on the weekends and short-term cruises in the summer, and we would have two regular force on board, the electrician and the hull tech. And they were the only two regular force on board, and all the rest were going to be reserve. But that whole concept led to some very significant changes in the Naval Reserve, which you probably want to hear about.
Yes, please.
Can we just take a break? I'm getting a little dry here.
For sure.
We're talking about the changes that occurred mostly as a result of the new coastal defense vessels. So I said before in the mid-80s we had put together this coastal defense organization. And there had been a lot of talk about bringing these new maritime coastal defense vessels in to be part of this coastal defense organization. Concept being that the way in which reserves would be employed wouldn't really change. We would just have new ships. But that didn't work. And what happened was that the fleet commanders and the admiral thought it would be silly to have these nice, shiny new ships tied up. And they didn't want them only run on weekends. They wanted them full time to do lots of things. But didn't change the concept that it was reservists who was going to be on board. So rather than just having these two full-time regular force caretakers on board, as it had been in the case of the Gate vessel, now we expanded from maybe a handful on full-time service to the need to have hundreds on full-time service if we were eventually going to grow to 10, manning 10 coastal defense vessels. That led us into needing to have a much larger headquarters staff, because in order for this to work, we were going to have a lot more career management, we were going to have a lot more logistics. And right about this time, the Naval Reserve, owing to the fact that we were going to have a lot more ships to man, coincided with a Liberal government effort to expand the Naval Reserve presence in Quebec. NPIQ, Naval Presence in Quebec. Working with the federal and provincial together, there was a decision to move the Naval Reserve headquarters from a small office down on South Street adjacent to Maritime Forces Atlantic to a gigantic new headquarters in Quebec City, and increase headquarters staff and add a lot more, five new Naval Reserve training centers, divisions, in Quebec. So that shifted everything. We now had a headquarters staff of several hundred. There was a co-located training center along there. And we had a lot more people serving full-time as a Naval Reservist in these coastal defense vessels. Concept being that now you couldn't just get a command ticket by training on weekends and doing part-time service. As these ships came online, you had to sign up for 2 to 3 years as the commanding officer and the executive officer. Equally, it was recognized that the engineering plant grew from a relatively manageable old diesel engine to a very computer-controlled, fancy engineering plant, equivalent to almost any modern ship. They were built to commercial standards. So the training requirements to get the engineering qualification grew as well. And so you no longer could do that part-time. It ended up that you had to serve full-time. So the full-time positions became the officer group. The engineering group in particular became critical, and all of these started to be long-term reservists. This began a time in the Naval Reserve then, which we call the Class A, Class B split. And just to clarify the terminology, Class A was a type of service where you served evenings and weekends. And Class B service was meant when you went on training with your regular force counterparts, but you did unique reserve courses. And Class C service was where you were doing a regular force job. Now, initially, these full-time positions on the coastal defense vessels were termed Class B. But instead of just being summers training, they became year-round positions called year-round Class B. And we ended up then with people who joined the Naval Reserve, had an affiliation with the Naval Reserve Division, going off on full-time service and losing their connection with the Naval Reserve that they joined. In fact, sometimes it was a perverse incentive to do that, because if you joined from Victoria and served on board these vessels and signed your contract in Victoria, then you lost some of the allowances and benefits just because you happened to go on full-time service in Victoria. You lost eligibility for housing and for some things. So a lot of time it would be, well, if you just transferred to Calgary and then went on full-time service, then you could get these benefits. So there was a bunch of crazy things that were happening. But the net result was there was a severing of the the primary relationship being with the Naval Reserve Division to the primary identification being for those on full-time service with the Navy and then with the coastal defense vessels. This went on from, I would say, the very first, the 1992 to the mid-90s when, I think it was 95, when we finally got the headquarters in Quebec City, to the late 90s where we were getting the last of the coastal defense vessels in. And we were becoming a naval reserve that was a very professional naval reserve, which was a good thing. But we were also becoming a naval reserve where there were two identifications. The naval reserve that the regular force saw were all the naval reservists serving full-time. And the naval reserve that the naval reserve saw was all these people serving full-time, but very few of them coming back to the naval reserve divisions. Now, there was a positive to this. When I joined, we were called the Boots and Berets because as we transitioned in the initial green uniform, there wasn't enough to issue us with the same kit as the Naval Reserve that as the regular force.
We are back with Commodore Gagliardi, Commodore Craig.
Did you interview Dave Gagliardi?
Yeah, I did earlier.
Yeah, there you are.
So yeah, please continue.
So coincident with all this and the opening of the new center in 95 was the establishment of the Naval Reserve as a separate formation because of the fact that we had now responsibility to monitor these and staff these new coastal defense vessels. And the Naval Reserve became a separate formation. The split between the people on full-time service and the Naval Reserve divisions was a gradual one. I would say that as the vessels came online, so did the number of people on full-time service become longer. But somewhere around the late 90s, it became noticeable that there were fewer and fewer returnees to the Naval Reserve divisions, and that the ability of a Naval Reservist to get a command ticket was becoming largely impossible. The last person who ever did this was Phil Horner, who did this on a part-time basis and had a full-time job. He was from Discovery. But the other people, like Dave Gagliardi, for example, had jobs that enabled him to do long periods of full-time service, and that was the only way you could get sufficient experience to command these vessels. Others, 2 to 3 years off, like a Doug Bancroft. Coincident with this as well was the fact that because the training programs were so long, although it was possible to get this training on a part-time basis, it became more and more difficult for people to get the requisite qualification to be promoted. So the people that were being promoted were the people on full-time service, and we were stagnating our Naval Reserve divisions. This led to a recognition that, in effect, we had mobilized the Naval Reserve for people who were available for full-time service voluntarily. And we were limiting ourselves with the usefulness of those people who were on part-time service and frustrating them because, in a lot of cases, the leadership of the local Naval Reserve divisions was lacking. We could not generate and sustain people who were the core of that group, the petty officers, the leading seamen, the chiefs, that would be the core of training a Naval Reserve. This led us to the initial strategic planning meeting back in 2010, where we needed to come up with a decision of what did we want the Naval Reserve really to be. Because the model that we were on, I think, was unsustainable. We needed to decide, is the Naval Reserve going to be an operational force? In which case, we probably needed to recognize that fact and give priority to the full-time service in effect, we were doing that anyway because we were giving most of the funds. We were giving over two-thirds of the funds in the Naval Reserve to people on full-time service. But then we would have to consciously say we need to make significant changes to our part-time people. I mean, maybe we need a lot fewer of them. We had created this establishment called the NERVS Establishment, Naval Reserve Establishment Verification Study. And we had predicated this on this model that people would choose to do full-time service and come back to the Naval Reserve and built a big establishment of 5,000 people predicated on this idea of part-time, full-time service. Recognizing, though, in the end, that we had two distinct tank camps. We had those on full-time service that were 400 to 500 that were largely recirculating, and then we had a bunch of other people in the Naval Reserve who largely were underutilized. So we had the strategic planning meeting in 2010, the outcome of which was we need to change the way we do business, both in the regular force and in the reserve. Part one of this in the regular force was the radical shift to a functional organization, which said that we need to have organizations of the Navy that don't duplicate fleets. We had an East Coast and a West Coast fleet, each having their own training centers, each having their own logistical functions. That was all merged together. And the East Coast became the center for operational deployment, and the West Coast became the center for training. That was Strategic Planning Meeting 1. Strategic Planning Meeting 2 focused on exclusively on what do we want the Naval Reserve to be? What do we want them to do? And the decision was made at that point, we need to return the Naval Reserve to being more of a part-time organization. And the conscious decision was made then that we were going to transition those people who were very long-term Naval Reservists and offer them full-time regular force careers. We were going to enhance the manning of the coastal defense vessels to include regular force and reserve together without really that kind of restriction. And we were going to increase the opportunities for Naval Reservists, not just to serve on Naval Reserve coastal defense vessels, but expand their manning to be part-time manning on all our platforms. So the number of billets on board frigates and destroyers grew. Equally, we looked at roles the Naval Reserve could do that could be achievable training-wise on a part-time basis. So for those who were intelligence experts, we could do analysis and reserve units doing background intelligence work on a part-time basis. For those who were going to sea, we could train them in certain trades like bosun, signalman, and other trades that were sustainable enough that you could train somebody at a junior level to do a function on a ship. Engineering-wise, we said, this doesn't make any sense. We're not going to be able to train an engineer who is not an engineer in the regular force. So the engineering staff became regular force on these ships. And the reserve, over that period of time, transitioned back to a part-time service. We also recognized that as in Strategic Plan Meeting 1, we centralized the training. We said it doesn't make sense to have the Naval Reserve have a separate training anymore. Let's bring it all under one Commodore, personnel and training on the West Coast. The Naval Reserve will still have a Commodore, but that Commodore will be responsible primarily to make sure that there is a healthy, sustainable, growing Naval Reserve and a part-time organization. And so I became the last formation commander as we transitioned out of that model back into a functional model, back into a part-time organization.
I'd like to return to how you were saying before it wasn't like that. What was it like in the 90s in the sense of Naval Reserve personnel?
In the 90s?
What was your role?
Before I became Commodore?
No. What was the role of the Naval Reserve?
The role of the Naval Reserve went from the late 80s to the early 90s when the coastal defense vessels came as a coastal defense organization. So even though we didn't have the ships, we had the paper organization to guard our coastline, to be the one in effect to do the immediate surveillance of the harbors and the coastal areas, which had been the role of the gate vessels in the past. I mentioned I went on this herring row patrol. We just didn't have enough ships to do that. We had two ancient 1950s. I presume you know what a gate vessel is. It's a vessel that used to put gates across the harbor. But equally, we had everyone assigned to a port in the harbor and an organization that divided the coast in north and south, and we had a paper organization that could do the coastal manning and leave the regular force to go off and do the deep blue water manning, if you like. Then when the coastal defense vessels came, we went through this whole issue that I just talked to you about, where it was realized that there was far more operational work to do, like they're doing right now on South Ploy and searching for drugs and doing those things that are really operational deployments away from Canada. We just had to use those ships because we had no other ships available.
Mm-hmm. What was it like directing the STAR 2?
That's a whole nother story, which is a part of my career. I became involved with the STAR program. Let me say what the STAR program is. It's Staff Training Air Reserve. Gee, that's a funny thing. How does Air Reserve come into this? But at the time, we didn't have a program to train our lieutenant and the lieutenant commanders in staff. And we knew that the Air Reserve had this program in Toronto where they ran a program for air reservists, and we said, this is a great thing. This was back in the mid-80s, so a long time ago. Mm-hmm. We'll piggyback on that. We'll provide a joint program. If we can send our officers on your program, we'll do the staffing and manning. Because their problem was, in the Air Reserve, they didn't have anybody to man it. They had a few people to put through it, but they didn't have any people who were available full-time. So we had the full-time people, and we provided staff for them, and we ended up providing the bulk of the program people to go through. So in effect, we took over the Air Reserve program. And there were two of them. There was STAR 1, which was designed for lieutenants, and that was a month-long program. And then there was STAR 2, which was for lieutenant commanders, and that was equally a month-long program. The program was modeled as much as we could on duplicating what the regular force did. So as time went on, we incorporated a lot more of the type of things that the regular force was training, but we managed to do it in a compressed amount of time. I was the program director in the end for the STAR 2 program, and I had a number of staff. During that time that I was the program director, we started to explore with the college and said, well, since we're doing a lot of your exercises and incorporating a lot of them, would it be possible to create a distance learning program during the winter months where they did a number of these assignments remotely and eventually duplicate the qualification that you're offering? And the college was enthusiastic and wanting to get on board because they also wanted to increase the flow of students through their organization. But they couldn't do it because of the bottleneck of residents on. But they could in the summer because they could just bring some people in with us. So the STAR 2 program morphed into the Joint Reserve Command and Staff Program Distance Learning, which ran for a number of years, and we trialed it out and we proved that we could duplicate the program, which then morphed into the joint the command and staff program identical to the regular force, where now most of the students on were distance learning regular force students, and the reserve were a part of that. And Star just disappeared. So after I finished my time as director and started this transitional process, I stayed on and became a civilian employee doing the distance learning as a distance learning supervisor. So I actually worked for them up until 2015 when I retired.
Awesome. And another important position that you held was the PSU for Commander for Maritime Forces Pacific. Could you explain?
That was a very brief time, only a couple of years, but it went along with this whole concept of the Coastal Defense Organization, a subset of which was that we at Naval Reserve would be responsible for guarding the ports and harbors. Very interesting, because it was quite a successful program. We did exercises over in Winter Harbor on the other side with the Americans. They also have called their units port security units. I was port security commander for a number of years, doing joint exercises with them. We had the gate vessels involved because they didn't have any ship assets, and that's something we could bring. But it was a new experience for us in that it was more Army-ish. It was guarding harbors, and so it was wearing Army fatigues and black berets to show that we were Navy, but more training in Army-type things and Army kitchens. And the port security units, the Americans had Army tents. It was an interesting time. I eventually learned how to tie up combat boots, but just a different experience for me.
Mm-hmm. And from that position, you moved forward to the Western Region Coordinator?
Yes. So that was another interesting transition. I became a captain in 1998. At the time I became a Naval Reserve captain, we had a large number of captains who didn't really have any particular role other than being the upper council to advise the senior Naval Reserve advisor. And at one point, I think there were up to 11 captains. And they would meet at what they would call formation council meetings in Quebec City, the new headquarters. That's when I became a captain. And as time went on, we recognized that with the stand-up of the Naval Reserve formation and the need to have a much sharper organization, we downsized from this large number of captains down to 4 or 5 and gave them jobs. So rather than simply giving advice, we invented these positions of strategic advisor for training, strategic advisor for planning, and focused our efforts so that each of these people would have people in their regions. Instead of just having a function, you had a function and you had a region that you were in charge of. So you coordinated and became not a line commander for the Naval Reserve units in your area, but you perform functions.
And what kind of functions?
Mostly a mentor to them, and some ceremonial functions. If there was something done in the area, then needed a captain to be at, rather than the commander trying to cover all of those bases, the Naval Reserve captain would do that.
Okay. And then after this position, you became the director of the Joint Command and Staff course at the Canadian College, is that correct?
Yes, that's what I was talking about, the STAR 2 to... I was a directing staff under STAR 2 for a number of years, and then when it transitioned to the Joint Reserve Command and Staff course, I became its director.
Okay. And so after all these positions, you carried on to becoming the commanding officer at HMCS Malahat?
No, that's a little bit backwards.
Okay.
I became the commanding officer of HMCS Malahat back in 92.
Right.
And then I went to do my master's degree PhD, actually, in Ottawa. And so I was commanding officer Malahat from 92 to 95. Mm-hmm. And then from about 95 to 98, I did work as a commander, the commander of Port Security Unit, doing my time doing gate vessel commands. And in 98 became a Naval Reserve Captain, and at that point the position of Joint Reserve Command and Staff head was Naval Reserve Captain.
Right. Okay. Could you actually tell me a day in the life of being the commanding officer at HMCS Malahat then?
Very busy. I became the commanding officer just after we moved to the new facility at Shoal Point. So I was first to warm the seat there for, and it was a time where everything was brand new. The building was brand new, the staff were adjusting to new facilities. So I would typically go down twice a week to work during the lunch hours. I would have it at midnight on Tuesday night. I would have a drill night on Thursday. And then at least once a month, I would go out to sea as the commanding officer. And that, having a young family of 2 and 4 year olds at the time, made my life extremely busy, mm-hmm. as well as having a full-time job.
Mm-hmm. And could you tell me more about how you managed to balance that?
With a very understanding wife and supportive wife. But I also tried to involve my kids, so I would take them on family cruises. I would try to have a time at least a couple of times a year where you could take your family out with you on the weekend and they could see what you did and take them down. And they were a part of, as much as I could, family events at the Naval Reserve Unit. I find that that's probably gone a little bit by the wayside now, that there's not the same family events, but I don't know. What I saw there was, as we went to this model of more full-time, part-time reserve, that it became very difficult for people to balance a young family with the demands of the Naval Reserve. And we experienced a lot of losses in the Naval Reserve just because we were burning people out. Either you went on full-time service and you could do this and still have your time on the weekends, or you were trying to do the Naval Reserve job, but the job was becoming more and more and more demanding.
And after you became the last formation commander, that you decided to retire, why did you decide on that?
Well, it was decided for me. I became ancient at the age of 60.
Mm-hmm.
And there are no options when you turn 60, you retire. But I wasn't too sad about that, because although it's always difficult to leave after 42 years, I was retiring as well. I had retired from my civilian job. I now had grandchildren to be concerned about, and I was ready to just spend some more time with my wife and at home. Not that I had any options, really. At 60, I retired in August of 2015 and turned 60 in September of 2015.
Mm-hmm. And after this long career, what would you like to see in the Naval Reserve? What kind of changes or improvements?
I think we're already seeing it.
Mm-hmm.
So after the second strategic planning meeting, the realization that we had operationalized the Naval Reserve to the detriment of our part-time organization, that we were on an unsustainable path for training demands, and that we were burning out our best and brightest people by not giving them the opportunity to get qualifications to be advancing in rank. All of those things were hoisted in by our regular force counterparts. They've given us jobs now that are interesting and sustainable jobs to do. So we now do the, we don't call them port security units, that was all done away with, but they're now naval security teams, which allow, and they're deployable away from Canada. So you can go and provide security over in the Philippines or do something that is really operational at the same time achievable part-time. We have moved away from trying to have naval reservists do nothing but full-time service and recognize that if they're going to do that, why would you call them reservists? Why not make them regular force? I mean, we'd already reached that point where we had transitioned those people serving on those ships from Class B service, which I talked about as being a lesser pay than to a Class C, which is saying you're doing a regular force job. You should get a regular force full pay for doing it. Yeah. So it only made sense. I think we're already seeing the benefits of that. We're seeing an enhanced retention and interest in the Naval Reserve. One thing that I have noticed, though, that is been an ongoing change, which aligns our military to our civilian culture, is that there's much less rank status. So when I joined, if you were a university student, you became an officer. University ship was associated with being an officer, and if you had a lesser education, you were in the regular form. Or in the lower deck, you were an enlisted person. That's all gone by the wayside. Now, if you're a university student, you're less concerned with what rank you have than what job you do. So if you think that it sounds really interesting to be a communicator, but you are a master's degree student, you don't care. You're really concerned about how much time do I have to put into this, and what really interests me? Maybe cooking interests you as a hobby, and you want, because you don't want your vocation necessarily to align with your hobby, which is being part-time in a naval division. You're more looking for availability and opportunities. So this whole class system, the whole business of university students being officers, that's pretty well done away with.
So you brought us some documents. Are there some achievements or accomplishments that you'd like to share with me?
Mostly they're just certificates and pictures. I would have to go through them and think, what would I give you? But it's more a memory lane for me of pictures of times in my career, certificates that I earned, things that I did. As much to jog my memory of this interview as anything else. I would be willing to possibly leave things with you if you gave me an idea of what kind of things you'd be interested in.
Is there an achievement that you're most proud of that you would like to share?
I think my one of the things I'm quite proud of is being the inaugural graduate of the Advanced Military Studies Course 1, the very difficult course. Course 1, version 1.0 of anything, is very difficult. And I spent 4 months gaining this qualification, which really set me up to become the Joint Reserve Command and Staff Program person, because this course was run in 1998, after I'd just become a captain, and was designed to professionalize the general corps, the general officer corps. And I had to do a number of very demanding academic papers, which subsequently people recognized burnt out that whole initial class. I had to do 2 papers, and the current ones only have to do 1, and the academic standards were very high. So I was quite proud of managing to complete that course. It was probably one of the most demanding parts of my career.
And is there anything else that you would like to share that you haven't yet?
I would say that I said I was ready to retire, but you don't really take the military out of you when you've spent your whole life as part of it. So I found that after I retired, I had a real passion just to keep my contacts, and so I became part of the UNTD organization reunions, talking to people. I really look forward to the Naval Association meetings, hearing what's going on, and I keep track of things. And I still like to go to events like mess dinners, just to keep track of how things are changing. I'm very optimistic for the future of the Naval Reserve. I think it's gone back full circle to being a part-time organization. But unlike when I was joining this organization, because we went through this whole episode of operationalizing the Naval Reserve and showing we could do things and showing we were the equal or could be the equal professionally of any regular force person, the Naval Reserve now has a lot of respect and support and integration into one Navy. So much so that I would say, branding-wise, we are now the RCN. So if you ask somebody, if you go on Facebook, if you look at anything that's published, it's all about the RCN. It's not about any separate Naval Reserve. I don't call myself Royal Canadian Navy Reserve retired. I am retired from the RCN. And there is really no, some people would lament this. I don't in particular. There is no real separate fixed identity anymore. We're just full and part-time members of the Navy. I view as a healthy thing. Some people may not. It's my 2 cents worth.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. And do you have anything more to say? Or
happy to have had this opportunity to reminisce.
Yeah, for sure. And this concludes the Military Oral History Program interview with Commodore Craig on March 14th. We have both signed the interview release form. Is that correct?
We do.
Okay. Well, thank you so much.